Chapter 12. Our workshop stood empty as a barn before harvest, so we had decided not to sell again the taxi we had bought, but to drive it ourselves for a while. Lentz and I were going to take it by turns. Custer and Jupp could look after the workshop quite well alone, until work came again. I stuffed my pockets with change, took my papers, and cruised slowly along the streets to look out for a good stand for myself. This felt a bit queer the first time. Any fool could stop me and give me orders. Not especially grand feeling. Slipped down a bit once more. I don't quite know why I should have made more of it this time than before. Still, perhaps it wasn't forever. And anyway, a sight better than in an office, letting yourself be bullied by some liverish head clerk until you seized the ledger and flung it at him and got the sack. I selected a place where there were only 5 cars standing. It was opposite the Waldeckerhof Hotel, in the center of the business quarter. There one might hope for quick business. I turned off the engine and got out. From one of the front cars, a big fellow in a leather coat came toward me. "Clear out of this," he growled. I looked at him calmly and calculated that it had better be an uppercut if necessary. His coat would prevent him getting his mitts up quickly enough. "You've no cap?" he persisted, spitting the butt of his cigarette at my feet. "You'd better clear out. Enough here. Don't want any more." He was annoyed at the addition, that was clear, but it was my right to stand here if I would. "I don't mind standing a few rounds entrance," said I. That would have ended the matter as far as I was concerned. It was the usual way when one came new. A young driver came up.
"All right, mate, let him alone, Gustav."
But there was something Gustav did not like about me. I knew what it was. He sensed that I was fresh on the job.
"I'll count up to 3, he announced.
He was a head taller than I, and was counting on it. I saw it was not much use talking. Either I must go, or fight. It was too pointed.
1, counted Gustav, unbuttoning his coat.
"Don't be silly," said I, trying once more. "Wouldn't you sooner feel a whiskey sizzling in your throat?"
2,
growled Gustav. I saw he meant to slaughter me properly.
"And 1 is..."
He pushed his cap back on his head.
"Shut your mouth, fool,"
I snapped suddenly. Gustav opened his mouth in astonishment and came a step nearer. Exactly where I wanted to have him. I let fly at once. A blow like a hammer, with the whole weight of my body behind it. Custer had taught it to me. I was not much of a boxer. I considered it unnecessary. It was usually a matter of the first blow. This was a good one. Gustav dropped in his tracks.
"Won't do him any harm," said the young driver. "He's always spoiling for it."
We put him back on the box of his cab. "He'll come round shortly." I was a bit perturbed, for I had put my thumb out with the blow. When Gustav waked up, he would be able to do what he liked with me. I told the young fellow and asked if I had not better hop it.
"Nonsense," said he. "The thing is settled. Come over into the pub and stand your entrance fee. You're not a trained cabman, eh?"
"No,
neither am I. I'm an actor."
"And you make a go of it?"
"One lives," he replied, laughing, "and it's not altogether unlike a play."
There were 5 of us, 2 older and 3 younger. After a while, Gustav also put in an appearance. He looked, glared across at our table, and came over. With my left hand, I gripped the bunch of keys in my pocket and resolved to defend myself till I could not move anymore. But it did not come to that. Gustav kicked a chair up and dropped into it ill-humoredly. The host put a glass in front of him. The beer came. Gustav tipped it down. A second round was called. Gustav looked at me askance. He raised his glass.
"Prost,"
said he to me, but with a face like mud. "Prost," I replied, and touched glasses. Gustav produced a packet of cigarettes. He proffered it to me without looking at me. I took one and gave him a light. Then I ordered a round of double Kimmel. We drank them. Again, Gustav gave me a sidelong glance.
Blighter, said he, but the tone was right.
Fathead, I replied in like manner.
He turned and faced me.
It was a good punch.
Fluke, said I, and showed him my thumb.
Bad luck, he replied with a grin. Gustav's my name, by the way.
Robert, mine.
Good. Then okay, Robert, eh? Thought you'd just left your mother's apron string. Okay, Gustav.
From that time on, we were friends. The cabs moved slowly forward. The actor, who was called Tommy, got a topping fare to the station. Gustav won to the nearest restaurant for 30 pfennig. He almost exploded with wrath, for he must now, for a profit of 10 pfennig, take his place again at the end of the line. I landed something quite special, an old English woman wanting to look over the town. I was underway with her almost an hour. On the return journey, I picked up several smaller runs. By noon, when we assembled again at the pub and were eating our rolls and butter, I already felt like an old hand. There was something of the camaraderie of the army about it. Men of every conceivable calling were there. At most, about half had done it always. The rest had just fallen into it, one way or another. Fairly pleased with myself, I drove into the yard of our workshop during the afternoon. Lentz and Custer were waiting for me.
How much have you made, brothers? I asked.
70 liters of petrol, reported Jupp.
Is that all?
Lentz looked desperately at the sky.
For a drop of rain, and then a little collision on the skiddy asphalt right in front of the door. No one injured, of course, just a nice, fat little repair job.
Take a look at this.
I showed 35 marks in the palm of my hand.
Magnificent, said Custer.
That's 20 marks profit.
We'll blow them at once. Must celebrate the maiden voyage.
We're going to have a bowl of Woodruff wine, announced Lentz.
Bowl? I asked. What do you mean, bowl?
Well, Pat's coming.
Pat?
Don't open your trap so wide, said the last of the romantics. We fixed it long ago. We collect her at 7. She knows all about it. If you can't think of these things, then we must help ourselves. After all, it was through us you came to know her.
Otto, said I, did you ever see anything to beat this recruit for insolence?
Custer laughed.
What's wrong with your hand, Bob? You seem to be holding it a bit queer.
Dislocated, I think. I recounted the story of Gustav.
Lentz looked at it.
Quite. But in spite of your rudeness, as a Christian and retired student of medicine, I'll massage it for you.
Come along, Mr. Boxer.
We went into the workshop, and Gottfried got busy with my hand with some oil.
Did you tell Pat we were celebrating our first day jubilee as taxi drivers? I asked him.
Gottfried whistled.
Is that biting you already, lad?
Hold your tongue, I replied. Because he was right, probably.
Did you tell her?
Love, announced Gottfried imperturbably, is a beautiful thing, but it spoils character.
Solitude, on the other hand, makes one tactless.
Tact is a tacit agreement to ignore mutual failings instead of ridding yourself of them. That is to say, a despicable compromise. No self-respecting German veteran would stoop to it, baby.
What would you do then, in my place, said I,
if someone signaled you for a taxi ride and then you saw it was Pat?
He smiled.
I wouldn't ask her for her fare, anyway, my boy.
I gave him a dig that knocked him off his three-legged stool.
You grasshopper.
Do you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to collect her tonight in the taxi.
Excellent. Gottfried raised a hand in blessing. Only whatever you do, don't lose your freedom.
It is more precious than love, and you only find out afterwards. You are not getting the taxi all the same. We want it for Ferdinand Grau and Valentine. It's going to be a solemn but great evening. We were sitting in the garden of a small inn on the outskirts of the city. The wet moon hung like a red torch low over the forest. The flowery candelabra of the chestnut trees shimmered pale. The scent of the lilac was like a drug. And on the table before us, the big glass bowl with the wine smelling of woodruff looked in the dim light like a bright opal wherein was gathered up blue and mother of pearl, the last glow of evening. Already we had refilled it 4 times. Ferdinand was in the chair. Beside him sat Pat. She was wearing a pale pink orchid, which he had brought for her. Ferdinand fished a lace wing out of his wine and wiped it carefully on the table.
"Look at that now," said he. "This fly, gossamer, is a floor cloth to it. And they live one day, and then it's over."
He surveyed us all. "Do you know what is the most uncanny thing in the world, brothers?"
"An empty glass," replied Lentz.
Ferdinand obliterated him with a gesture.
"The most degrading thing in the world for a man, Gottfried, is to be a joker."
He turned to us again.
"The most uncanny thing in the world, brothers, is time. Time. The monument through which we live and yet do not possess."
He pulled a watch from his pocket and held it in front of Lentz's eyes.
"This here, you up-in-the-air romantic. This infernal machine that ticks and ticks, that goes on ticking, and that nothing can stop ticking. You can stay an avalanche, a landslide, but not this."
"I don't want to," declared Lentz. "I want to grow peacefully old. And anyway, I like change."
"It cannot abide man," said Grau, ignoring him. "Neither can man abide it. So he has concocted a dream for himself. The old, pathetic, hopeless human dream, eternity."
Gottfried laughed.
"The worst disease in the world, Ferdinand, is thought. It's incurable."
"If it were the only one, you'd be immortal," replied Grau. "You parcel of carbohydrates, calcium, phosphorus, and a little iron for a moment of time on the earth, Gottfried Lentz."
Gottfried beamed complacently. Ferdinand shook his lion head.
"Life is a disease, brothers. And death begins already at birth. Every breath, every heartbeat is a moment of dying. A little shove toward the end."
"Every gulp, too," replied Lentz.
"Prost, Ferdinand. Death can be damned pleasant sometimes." Grau raised his glass. A smile passed over his big face like a soundless storm.
"Prost, Gottfried. You water skipper on the running surface of time. What were the powers that move us thinking when they made you, I wonder?"
"They must settle that among themselves," said Gottfried.
"In any case, it's not for you to speak disparagingly of such things. If human beings were immortal, you'd be out of work, you old parasite on death."
Grau's shoulders began to heave. He laughed. Then he turned to Pat.
"What do you say, little flower on the dancing waters?"
Later, Pat and I were walking alone in the garden. The moon was higher, and the meadows swimming in silver gray. The shadows of the trees lay long and black across them, like dark signposts into the unknown. We went down as far as the lake, and then turned back again. En route, we met Gottfried, who had taken a garden chair and planted it in the midst of a thicket of lilac bushes. There he was now sitting, only his yellow head and his cigarette visible. Beside him on the ground, he had a glass, and what remained of the May bowl of hock flavored with woodruff.
"There's a place, if you like," said Pat, "among the lilacs."
It's tolerable. Gottfried stood up. Try it.
Pat sat on the chair. Her face shone among the blossoms.
I'm crazy about lilac, said the last of the romantics. Homesickness for me means lilac. In the spring of 24, I set off hell for leather from Rio de Janeiro, only because I remembered the lilac must be in flower here. When I arrived, of course, it was too late. He laughed. It's always so.
Rio de Janeiro. Pat drew a spray of blossom down toward her. Were you there together?
Gottfried jibbed. I felt a sudden cold shiver down my spine. Just look at the moon, said I swiftly, at the same time treading imploringly on Lentz's foot. In the glow of his cigarette, I saw a faint smile and a twinkle. I was saved.
No, we weren't together. I was alone that time.
But what do you say to a last swig of this Woodruff mixture?
No more, Pat shook her head. I can't drink a lot of wine. We heard Ferdinand calling to us and went across. But I resolved sometime to clear up the matter of Brazil. Gottfried was right. Love does spoil character. Ferdinand was standing massive in the doorway.
Come inside, children, said he. People like us have no business with nature at nighttime. She wants to be alone then. A farmer or a fisherman, that's a different matter, but not us town dwellers with our instincts sabered off.
He laid a hand on Gottfried's shoulder.
Night is nature's protest against the leprosy of civilization, Gottfried. No decent man can withstand it for long. He begins to notice that he has been turned out of the silent company of the trees, the animals, the stars, and unconscious life.
He smiled his queer smile. One could never be sure if it were sad or not.
Come inside, children. Let's warm our hands over memories. Ah, the wonderful time when we were horsetails and mudfish, 50, 60,000 years ago. God, but how low we have fallen since then.
He took Pat by the hand.
If we had not just this tiny sense of beauty, then all were lost.
With a delicate movement of his enormous flippers, he placed her hand on his arm.
Silver shooting star above the giddy abyss. Will you have a drink with an age-old man?
Pat nodded.
Yes, said she. Anything you like.
The two went in. Walking thus side by side, it looked as if Pat were Ferdinand's daughter, the slim, bold, and young daughter of a weary giant left over from prehistoric time. About 11, we drove back. Valentin and Ferdinand had the taxi, Valentin at the wheel. The rest of us went in Carl. The night was warm, and Custer made a detour through several villages that lay asleep by the roadside, with no sign of life but a few lights and a dog barking. Lentz was sitting in front with Otto, singing. Pat and I crouched low behind. Custer drove wonderfully. He took the curves like a bird. It looked like child's play, it was so sure. He was not a hard driver like so many racers. You might have slipped round hairpin bends. He held the car so steady, one was never conscious of the speed. We listened to the changing sound of the tires as the road surface altered. On tarred roads, they whistled. Over stone, thundered hollow. The searchlights coursed ahead like elongated greyhounds, and there started up out of the darkness now a trembling avenue of birches, a row of poplars, fleeting telegraph poles, squatting houses, and the mute parade of the forest's edge. Immense above us, with its millions of stars, trailed the bright mist of the Milky Way. The speed increased. I put our coats over Pat. She smiled at me.
Do you love me, really? I asked.
She shook her head.
Do you me?
No,
Lucky, isn't it?
Very.
Then nothing can happen to us, eh?
Nothing,
she replied, and felt for my hand under the coats. The road ran in a big sweep beside the railway line. The rails gleamed. Away in front of us, a red light wavered. Carl bayed and shot away. It was an express with sleeping cars and one brightly lit dining car. Gradually, we drew up level with it. From the windows, people waved. We did not wave back. We drove past. I looked round. The locomotive was spouting smoke and sparks. It pounded along, black through the blue night. We had overtaken it. But we were driving to the city, to taxis, repair shops, and furnished rooms, while it would keep steadily on past forests, fields, and rivers, to the adventure of distant and more spacious lands. Streets and houses came toward us. Carl became gentler, but his roaring was still that of a wild creature. Custer drove neither to Pat's nor to my place, but stopped near the graveyard in the neighborhood of both, thinking apparently that we wanted to be alone. We got out. The other two whirled off at once, without looking round. I glanced after them. It felt queer for a moment that they, my mates, should drive off and I remain behind. I dismissed the thought. Come on, said I to Pat, who was watching me as if she had sensed something.
Go with them, said she.
No, I replied.
You would like to have gone with them, though.
Ah, why, said I, knowing it to be true.
Come.
We walked past the graveyard. We were still a bit rocky from the wind and the driving.
Bob, said Pat. I think I'd rather go home.
Why?
I don't want you to give up anything on my account.
What are you talking about? Said I. What am I giving up?
Your friends.
I'm not giving them up at all. I'll see them again first thing in the morning.
You know what I mean, though, said she. You used to be with them much more before.
Because you weren't there, I replied, and opened the door. She shook her head.
That's different.
Of course it's different. Thank God. I picked her up and carried her along the corridor to my room.
You need comrades,
said she close to my face. I need you, too, I replied.
But not so much.
We'll see about that. I bumped the door open and let her slip to the ground. She clung to me.
I'm only a very poor comrade, Robbie.
Let's hope so, said I. Anyway, I don't want a woman as a comrade. I want a lover.
I'm not that either,
she murmured. What are you, then?
Only half. Nothing whole. A fragment.
That is best of all, said I. That stirs the imagination. Such women one loves forever. Perfect women one soon gets over. Worthy ones likewise. Lovely fragments. Never. It was 4 in the morning. I had taken Pat home and was on my way back. The sky was already growing bright. There was a smell of morning. I was walking along by the cemetery, past the Café International, toward home, when the door of a taximan's pub next to the trades hall opened and a girl came out. A little toque, a short, shabby red coat, high patent leather boots. I was almost by when I recognized her. Lisa.
So there you are again, said she.
Where have you come from, then? I asked. She made a movement.
I've been waiting there a while. Thought you'd probably be passing. This is around your time for coming home, isn't it?
Yes, that's right.
Coming along?
She asked. I hesitated. I can't, really.
You don't need any money, she said hastily.
It's not that, I answered thoughtlessly. I have money.
Ach so, said she bitterly, stepping back a pace.
I took her hand.
No, Lisa.
Slim and pale, she stood in the empty gray street. It was so I had met her years ago, when I had been living brutish and alone, without care and without hope. She had been mistrustful at first, like all these girls. But then, after we had talked together several times, quite pathetically confiding and devoted, it had been a curious relationship. Sometimes I would not see her for weeks on end, and then suddenly she would be standing somewhere waiting. We had neither of us anybody or anything at that time, so what little bit of warmth and companionship we could give one another had probably meant more to us than it would have otherwise. I had not seen her for a long time. Since I had known Pat, not at all.
Where have you been all this while, Lisa?
She gave a shrug.
What's it matter? I just wanted to see you again. Well, I suppose I can push off, of course.
How are things going, then?
Don't worry, said she. Don't put yourself out.
Her lips were quivering. She looked half-starved.
I'll come along with you for a bit, said I.
Her poor, apathetic prostitute's face brightened and became almost childlike. On the way, at one of the cabmen's shelters that are open all night, I bought a few small things so that she should have something to eat. She was unwilling at first, and only agreed when I explained that I was hungry myself. But she saw to it that I was not cheated and given inferior stuff. She was opposed to the half pound of bacon. She said a quarter would be plenty if we took a couple of small frankfurters as well. But I stood out for the half, and two tins of sausages. She lived in an attic room, which she had furnished herself. An oil lamp was on the table, and beside the bed in a bottle, a candle. On the walls hung pictures cut out of newspapers and fastened with drawing pins. On the chest of drawers lay a few detective novels, alongside a packet of dirty photographs. Her visitors, especially married ones, liked to look at them sometimes. Lisa swept them into a drawer and took out a threadbare but clean tablecloth. I unpacked the things. In the meantime, Lisa undressed. First, she took off her dress, though I knew very well her boots were hurting her most. She had so much walking to do. There she stood, in her high patent leather boots to her knees, and her black underwear.
What do you think of my legs? She asked.
First class, as ever.
She was satisfied, and now sat down on the bed with a sigh of relief to unlace her boots. 120 marks they cost, said she, holding them up to me. And before you've earned it, they're through again.
She took a kimono from the cupboard and a pair of faded brocade slippers from better days. As she did so, she smiled, almost guiltily. She did want to please. I had a sudden choking feeling, up here in the little room, as if someone belonging to me had died. We ate, and I talked warily with her. But she perceived, for all that, that something had changed. Her eyes became fearful. There had never been any more between us than chance had brought. But perhaps that makes a greater indebtedness and binds closer than much else.
Are you going?
She asked as I stood up, as if she had already been fearing it. I have an appointment. She looked at me.
So late?
Business. Important for me, Lisa. Someone I must try to see still. At the Astoria, usually, around this time. No women are more sensible about such things than girls like Lisa. But no women are less easy to deceive. Lisa's face became empty.
You have another woman.
But Lisa, we've seen so little of one another. Almost a year now. You understand.
No, no. I don't mean that. You've a woman you love. You've altered. I can feel it.
Ach, Lisa.
Yes, yes. Admit it.
I don't really know myself, Lisa. Perhaps.
She stood a while. Then she nodded.
Yes. Yes, of course. And I'm so stupid. And we have nothing in common, really.
She passed her hand over her forehead.
I don't know how I came to...
Her slender figure stood before me, pathetically desiring and frail. The brocade slippers, the kimono, the long, empty nights. Memory. Au revoir, Lisa.
Are you going? You won't stay a bit longer. You were going already?
I knew what she meant, but I couldn't. It was extraordinary, but I couldn't, and I felt it strongly. It had never been so before. I had no exaggerated ideas about fidelity, but it simply was not possible anymore. I suddenly felt how far I had gone already from all that. She stood framed in the doorway.
You were going?
She ran back.
Here. I know you left some money for me, under the newspaper. I don't want it. There. There. Yes, only go.
I must, Lisa.
You will never come again.
Oh, yes, Lisa.
No, no, you will never return, I know. And you must never return. But go. Do go now.
She was crying. I went down the stairs and did not look back. I walked a long time through the streets. It was a strange night. I was still wakeful and could not sleep. I passed the International. I thought of Lisa and the years gone by, of many things that I had forgotten. But it was all far away, and seemed not to belong to me anymore. Then I wandered down the street where Pat lived. The wind became stronger. All the windows in her place were in darkness. Dawn was creeping on gray feet past the doorways, and at last I went home. My God, thought I believe I am happy.